Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And you know how we start every Friday with the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
It's Jericho. It's Duff McKagan calling you. And, you know, we haven't talked for a while. Hope you're well. You know, doing good here. Doing music and, you know, doing what I do. Oh, yeah, you know, you hear about the guy. He dipped his testicles in glitter. Yeah, pretty nuts. Thank you very much.
Yeehaw! Pretty nuts. I love it. Duff McKagan never failing to miss calling in a joke every single week. Hilarious, hilarious entertainment from one of the greatest guys I know in rock and roll and in the world, one of my favorite people. Duff's delivering the goods, as always, and he's delivering on the Tenderness Tour, and they're headed to Europe next month. That's Duff McKagan, Shooter Jennings, and the whole band. They start in Warsaw, Poland on August 22nd. Then they hit Germany, Ireland, France, Switzerland. And then they come back to do a fall tour of the United States starting September 25th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Get your tickets at duffonline.com. Okay. Also, get your tickets to the Bill Murray Stories, Life Lessons Learned from a Mythical Man, a great new documentary. It's on Netflix, done by my buddy Tommy Avalone. It tells the story of a random spontaneous interactions that people have had with Bill Murray over the years. All the crazy urban legend type things Bill has done that is actually true. Stuff like crashing someone's wedding, showing up to someone else's house to wash their dishes, playing in a college house party band. A lot of great stuff. I got a couple great Bill Murray stories of my own to share. Tommy's also going to talk about making the documentary, the strange accessibility of Bill Murray. Also, the doc he made a few years ago, I Am Santa Claus with Mick Foley. And he gives us a sneak peek at his upcoming film, Waldo on Weed, produced by Whoopi Goldberg. It's actually going to surprise you. It's not what you think, but I'll let Tommy explain it all to you. It's time for the Bill Murray Stories right here on Talk is Jericho. Okay, so it's interesting how it's a small world in that I've been working on a documentary. Talked to my manager, Barry. He said he manages Tommy Avalone.
Yes.
Who we met in, where were we? Lancaster, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, somewhere like Hershey, Allentown.
Something like that, at a venue. I remember Fozzy was on tour with Saxon, and you came to talk because I had an idea of doing a documentary.
Well, even before that, it was, well, with I Am Santa Claus, I did with Mick Foley.
Right.
And you and CM Punk signed some of our 8x10s for our Kickstarter.
That's what it was, right. Yeah, it's a documentary you made about real life Santas.
Yes.
Which is really well done.
Thank you.
And I had an idea of doing a documentary about Black Friday people.
Yeah.
The people that waited in line for like a couple days beforehand to get in a fight over a, you know, $400 TV. But then with the advent of Amazon and online shopping, there's really no more Black Friday people anymore.
I think when we started talking about it, it was like really like the cusp of it just like dying down, you know? And it's just like every year, because we looked into it, there was these two people in Ohio that were still like neck to neck would be number one or number three online, and they would wait a whole week, but it just wasn't, it's not the same.
That would be like doing a documentary about the Yellow Pages. we had our time, kid, and we let it go.
Yeah.
But just to talk about this is Santa Claus again, just as a brief catch up, that was a movie where you actually talked to three.
It was five Santas.
Five, and these are people that like are super into Santa. Like every year their life is for Christmas.
Yeah. They look like Santa all year round, and they're professional Santas, whether it's like private parties or mall Santas, and they bleached their hair white. They're, you know, somewhere around 300 pounds.
Mick Foley had grown a big beard out for that year.
So we followed like four Santas, and then Mick was the fifth. He was like the rookie Santa where he was like always thought about being Santa, but never like full time. And he bleached his beard white and became Santa, and he hasn't looked back.
That's right.
Yeah, he has his associate's degree, some sort of degree in Santa Clausology right now.
What the hell is that?
Yeah, well, it's a made up thing, you know?
It's like speaking Klingon.
Yeah.
But what was your, was that your first documentary?
It was, yeah.
So what was your mindset into getting into documentary filmmaking?
So like I always wanted to be Kevin Smith. You know, like I wanted to make Clerks. Like that was kind of my thing. And I had produced a couple scripted movies, one of which Kevin put out.
Which one?
It was called Miss December. It was like he was a Kevin Smith Presents.
Gotcha.
You know? Gilbert Godfrey's in it for like 5 minutes. So that was always what I wanted to do. I wanted to do scripted movies, but I had this idea for a documentary about Santa Claus. And one thing led to another, and I met Morgan Spurlock, and I told him about the idea, and he's like, well, that's a good idea. And we kind of like kept in touch, and I just kind of moved forward and thought this was something I wanted to do. And at the time, I really wasn't the best director as far as actors. Like I couldn't like tell someone what to do that was in my head to like for them to perform it, but I was really good at putting together docs. Like I edit them and I'm directing them as well. So it just kind of came out that I thought I was a lot better at this version of it mm-hmm. opposed to being the Kevin Smith. You know?
Well, and like I said, from working on the documentary that I've been with, the guy directing, this guy called Nathan Mowry, who did all the Fozzy videos, mm-hmm. if you've seen Judas or Painless. And, mm-hmm. You know, I had the idea of doing this, and then he went and filmed it and then pieced it together, edited it together, you know, then we started working on the cut. But there's such a talent to it. You're very good at it as well, of the pacing and the comedic timing and when to switch a shot, when to add a little additional shot and telling the stories of the people. I mean, there's a real trick to it.
And, you know, and I think as a wrestler too, like you guys are good at it. Cause like when we were doing I Am Santa Claus, like Mick would come over to my house and it was almost like he was putting a promo together. He's like, that's your go home. Right. You know, like mm-hmm. there was a certain part in Santa where one Santa had this really, really nice gig. It was like right at the Grove or Americana in California. And the other one's in this like dirty apartment in Minnesota. And he's like, we should put them back to back so you can see the comparison. He's like, Santa Bob right here, he makes his heel turn right here. You know, and like, or like when Santa, like Rob Figley was saying something, he's like, oh, he's like, that's your go home moment. Like he would like help me and put talk in wrestler, like mm-hmm. wrestling to him. Like, and he, because of knowing what to say and when to leave someone wanting more, he was able to help me like really trim some of the edits. Mm. And I think that's one of those, I'm sure what you're adding to your documentary.
Yeah, for producing it, with the streamlining it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like he put together this great narrative, but like this needs to be there, pull this out, cut that. This moment has great energy and then there's 10 seconds of no energy to lead to this other moment of energy. But like I said, to be able to take all this footage and assemble it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it takes hours and hours yeah. and hours and hours and hours to do it. You know?
It does. It's super crazy because there's no one person going to make the same movie with the same footage. So it's really just like your perspective.
Right.
And I firmly believe like once you watch it enough, the movie like presents itself. You know,
yeah, the story tells itself.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The one that we did was a friend of mine when he was 18 was in a heavy metal band in Brandon, Florida, which at the time was the heavy metal capital of the world.
Okay.
They made a 7-inch disc, floated over to Germany, band got in a big argument, broke up. Never played in another band again. 30 years later, a promoter of a festival contacts them and says, we want Siren to come play this festival because you guys are huge here. Like, what?
Right.
You have a huge fan base. From what? From where? So after 30 years of putting the dream aside, they now assemble the band to go and for one night be rock stars 30 years later.
Yeah.
And I thought, when as soon as I heard that, I was like, okay, this is going to go one of two ways. A, it's either going to be a catastrophe. Everything's going to go wrong, which is going to make for a great
right.
film.
Well, that's
or everything goes right and it's an uplifting human story about dreams can come true. Never give up.
Right.
And lo and behold, it went really good. And that's what we have. It's a real great heartwarming awesome. Story about rock and roll. So it's called I'm Too Old for This Shit, a heavy metal fairy tale.
I love
so that's
that.
Kind of, but like I said, that was the idea for it. Now I sent Nathan out to get it.
Yeah.
What are you looking at for a documentary? Because you don't know what's going to happen.
Right. Well, I mean, well, go back to what you're saying about something bad happening. It's like you have to like completely remove all sort of humanity at some point because like there's people who make documentaries about like lions like killing like
right.
things in the wild. You're not right. going to like stop and go, hey, maybe we shouldn't be killing this animal here. You kind of have to watch the thing happen,
sure.
you know? So like when you're saying something bad could happen, that it's like you're only going to see directors go, no, that could be good.
Well, then, yeah. We hope it does. It's like if you look at like my two favorite documentaries is Some Kind of Monster,
okay.
the Metallica
yep.
movie, where they were filming Metallica doing their new record. And then suddenly the band breaks up halfway through. James yeah. goes insane, disappears for a year. Newstead quits. Lars is left as the sole survivor. Then they made this incredible movie. They didn't know that was going to happen
right.
when the movie first was filming. Wrestling with Shadows, same thing. They didn't know that Vince was going to double cross Brett, leading to Brett knocking Vince out and all this stuff that happened.
Yeah.
That's just when the real life came in. So when you're going out to film a documentary, where do you get the idea from? And also, like for Santas, it's more of a piece about these guys, right?
Yeah. So like, For Santa in particular, you know, we had five different Santas. So it's kind of like one person's story, but told from five different people's perspectives.
Yeah.
You know, Mick was the rookie. So you're getting to understand the world of Santa Claus, you know, how to become, you know, to get a degree in Santa Clausology, all these sort
with
of things.
With a very famous guy, let's be honest.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that Well, see, I'm a huge, huge wrestling fan, and we put a wrestler in every single one of our movies. We at least try to, you know? So one of my buddies like, you know, Mick's actually like a big fan of Santa. I was like, well, this makes sense, you know? And like, he's like a lifelong friend. Like, he was my son's first Santa, which is an unbelievable.
Mick was?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Because I was living in New Jersey at the time. And he's like, I'm coming in for Raw. He's like, I'm going to get a hotel. I'll have the backdrop. He's like, we'll do Santa. He's like, he wanted to be my son's first Santa. So it was awesome.
Now, why do you always want to put a wrestler in your movies?
I'm just a big fan, you know, of wrestling. My grandfather got me watching WrestleMania 9, and I just like fell in love with it.
But you're a filmmaker though. You're not doing it just to be a fanboy. Right. Well,
no, but they're great performers. Like, so gotcha. When we were doing
great on camera,
yeah, of course. You know, like when we were doing scripted stuff, it was so much easier. You know, Tommy Dreamer was a strip club announcer. You know, Al Snow was a guy on TV.
For what?
Oh, these are different movies.
Gotcha,
we did.
Movie. Yeah, okay, I got
sorry, it's so a different scripted stuff.
I like, understand.
My first scripted movie, The Blue Meanie, is giving massages to some guy. It was like he had a couple different lines. Friends with Blue Meanie. You know, is this one of those things where like they're really good on camera? You guys are really good on camera, and also there's an audience there. People know who you are, so you're casting a star in some sense.
It's interesting because with Too Old for This Shit. I did an interview kind of as the devil's advocate. Like, there's no way that everything's going to go completely according to plan because this just doesn't happen. A band just doesn't get a call out of nowhere and suddenly go play in front of 5,000 people.
Right.
I'm calling bullshit on this. And my wife was watching. She goes like, are you trying to be an asshole? I was like, no, I'm just painting the other side of the story
because
I knew it had to be painted.
Yes.
Right. And also I know how to be on camera. So
yeah.
Those moments, it really ties some of the room together if you're Big Lebowski's rug.
Yeah.
Which you need to get with certain elements of your story.
Well, like, so we would interview these Santas and you would just like hours and hours of footage for some to get something good. You know, you sit down Mick and he's like, all right, boom. You're like, oh, that was so easy.
And if you're not getting Mick, can you say this? One line later.
Yeah.
Other times, and you'll probably notice, you can ask an untrained person to say something and they'll talk for 5 minutes and not say what you said. Tommy, say this is hot coffee. Oh, I had some coffee and it was real tasty and I was looking around. You didn't say it was hot. Oh, I didn't, sorry. Right?
Yeah. But yeah, and then so the other Santas were, we had a gay Santa. And it was like he was living in Texas and his boyfriend was in Denver. So it was
was my favorite one.
Yeah, there was a love story there. Our New York Santa identity, you know, he legally changed his name to Santa Claus. Our one Santa in Detroit, he lost his house. He lost his wife, divorced him. He lost his job. So he living in his daughter's basement. He used being Santa to lift himself out of depression. Mm-hmm. So he used it's really a movie about identity and community, you know, and like what we do to fill the holes in our heart. It just happens to be Santa Claus, you know. I couldn't care less about Christmas. It was like our movie wasn't about Santa. It was the people who portray Santa, and I think that's always the hook for any good movie. It's like it's not a good story.
Yeah,
it's
like Walking Dead's not about zombies. It's about how people are dealing with this new society. Right?
Exactly, it's Trojan horse sort of movies.
Right.
You go in, going, "Hey, isn't this fun? Look at this!" But then inside, there's a great message.
Yeah, that leads us perfect segue to the new documentary that you did, the Bill Murray Stories. Now, briefly, for people that don't know, and I've heard about this for a while, that Bill will just show up in different places and you know, like the one that you said, like do something crazy and go, no one's ever going to believe you and just run away. And you think, and we'll get into this because I have a few Bill Murray stories of my own.
Oh, great.
But there's a whole underlying message to this movie that I didn't even realize until you start watching it. Let's not jump forward to that. First of all, how did you get the idea to do this documentary and kind of tell us the road to get to it?
Sure. So, I mean, like, right off Santa, like, I knew I wanted to do this Bill Murray Stories.
Why?
Because, like, I just started hearing these things. It was actually Blue Meanie who told me my first Bill Murray story. You know,
Which one was that?
He goes, he's like, Bill Murray was in some bathroom, put his hand over someone's eyes, a urinal, and said, no one will ever believe you. I was like, that's silly. That's crazy.
Some guy put his hands over my eyes, and I don't care if he's Bill Murray or not, I'm going to punch him in his fucking face.
Exactly, right? But, like, so... I don't think that story necessarily is true. It was like a told by a,
told by a.
Exactly. So it's one of those things where that was what intrigued me too. But then I heard like he was in Scotland and did someone's dishes at a party. I was like, what is this?
So like, by the way, it's not a party that he's invited to.
Right.
He just shows up at someone's house.
Yeah.
They let him in and he does dishes.
So here's the thing, and this is something you could relate to because like, there's a million people who know who you are, but you don't know who they are. It's a really interesting relationship celebrities have. Mm. Where it's like Bill Murray has this like invite to everyone because they know who he is. And he's able to play with that in a positive way where like, he's like, I don't know who you are, but let's still have fun. You know, like is yes and this sort of...
It's something that Ronnie James Dio told me. I've said this on the podcast many times, but it's such a great, great statement. It's like, always give people their moment.
Yeah.
Because you won't remember it, but they'll never forget it.
5 seconds you're giving someone will mean the world to them.
Yeah, and you, they will never forget it. And you will never probably remember it.
Yeah.
But just give people their moment. And as we get through more of this documentary, it seems like Bill really thrives on giving people their moment and letting people know that we're all in this together.
I think it's his way of navigating this, you know, because it can be very overwhelming where it's like, you know, he can't be normal anymore.
He's one of the most famous people in the world.
Exactly. And he can't just go to the store and do whatever. So he's like, well, this is going to be on my terms. He doesn't have a manager. He doesn't have an agent. He just has a 1-800 number. Everything is on his terms.
Hold on a second. Now, when you say that, it's because you've heard that story 100 times, but let's just...
Sorry.
No, but I'm saying that it's amazing. Let's think about this. He's a Hollywood A-plus actor, A-plus lister. He doesn't have an agent or a manager or a publicist, which in this town means you're pretty much obsolete.
Right.
On top of that, he doesn't have a website. He doesn't have an email. He has a what?
A 1-800 number that like you call and it's like, it's not even like, hey, it's Bill. It's just like, you've reached this number. If you want to leave one for a number, two, like one for a page, two for a voicemail. It's just like, it's so an outdated service.
And if you want to cast Bill Murray, if I'm Steven Spielberg and I want to cast Bill Murray, I have to call the 1-800 number.
Yeah.
If he agrees to it, then what happens? Calls you back?
Well, there's a good story of Ted Melfi who did St. Vincent. Like, he kept calling this number. And Bill Murray was like, Bill Murray told his lawyer to reach out to Ted and had him FedEx a script to an area. You know, it wasn't his house. It wasn't just
like a P.O. box.
Yeah, it was just something that he would pick up, you know, and then he'd read the script. And if he liked it, then he would call you, you know, and that was how it was. Like, he had these like drop off points in like New York or South Carolina. And it was just a game.
So it's like he'll pick up the briefcase underneath the snow, like in Fargo.
Yeah.
So you had this idea. You've heard these stories.
Right. So I just thought that was really interesting. And I was like, I like these stories. They're fun. But I wonder if you could do it in a way where it was like Bigfoot. Like, Bill isn't Bigfoot because he's obviously real. But if you made a Bigfoot documentary about these stories, that could be interesting, you know? So our idea...
Even on the cover of your DVD, he says a Bigfoot.
Yeah. So like, our thought was make a detective/Bigfoot documentary. And so you want to, like, even with Santa, it's like right, you know, first couple minutes, you're like, okay, Santa's not real, but these guys are, you know? We don't want to ruin the magic of a Bill Murray story. Like, these are magical, fun things. So you don't want to like just directly just take the fun out of it. So it was like, how can you show that these things are existing, but then still also keep that lore and that funness with it? So that was the thought process. And I'm not a guy that's going to put himself in all his documentaries. Like, Santa Claus, I'm not in at all. Mm-hmm. But to me, like, the only way to do this...
Because you're the bridge, yeah.
Yeah, you need a through line. And it's not like, you know, like, hey, I'm Tommy Avalone and I'm going to have a Bill Murray story. You know, it's
you know, like I said, watching the majority of it, you are calling the 1-800 number and getting, first of all, great scene where you like pulling a swingers and he calls the girl's answering machine and it goes for 5 minutes because he keeps saying stupid things. You were lucky enough that you could erase it. So you kept trying and kept trying. He sounded like the biggest loser ever.
Right. Thank you.
I'm Tommy Avalone. I make documentaries. I got a real idea for a documentary that you might want to be in my documentary. Yeah. And I just said documentary again. Wah, wah, wah.
But that's the thing. It's like, you know, I thought of that scene from Swingers, you know, like after I'm putting it together. And like, there, I actually was leaving messages and stuff like that, but that wasn't fun. Like, the joke is the show the mistake, you know?
Right.
And then I had my mom call and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, so it was
I thought there might be a chance that he might have called you back on that one.
Yeah, I thought so too. Like, I'm friends with Morgan Spurlock, and he was telling me, he's like, your mom called, he'll call back. And he never called back. No.
So just take a couple steps back. So how do you put together a Bill Murray documentary?
Right. So and I'll try to make this short, but like, so when we were doing Santa, I knew I wanted to do this thing. I had this idea for the Bill Murray stories. So we just started, I lived in New Jersey, started filming local stuff, you know, like the kickball stories in New York, the dodgeball stories.
Well, tell us some of the stories.
Oh, sorry. So there was a kickball game in Brooklyn or somewhere around New York, and Bill Murray just randomly joined their kickball game and just started playing along. You know, it just was viral, sort of, you know, it was on Chive, it was on all these sorts of things. And that's, you know, more or less it. And then there's one story where this guy was doing karaoke And
at a bar?
Yeah, a karaoke bar in New York. And the guy saw Bill Murray. He's like, would you like to join us? He's like, no. And then like 5 minutes later, he comes in. They're belting out Elvis tunes, you know? And it was like this whole long night. And they took pictures and they put it online. So these interesting stories, but you're just seeing the picture and Bill Murray showed up, but you're not hearing much more about it, you know? So we went to New York and filmed some of these things and started putting together the sizzle tape, you know, because all my ideas are awful on paper. Santa, Bill Murray, this new movie I did, Waldo and Weed, like they're all bad ideas on paper that no one can understand. So we have to make these like sizzle tapes. So in doing so, we interviewed some New York City Ghostbusters, some New Jersey Ghostbusters. We thought, these people must have an opinion on Bill Murray. They're a big fan, right? And then we started seeing that there was a Ghostbusters fan documentary being made called Ghost Heads. And my idea was, if I interview some of these people, I'll ask. I reached out to the director. He's a Canadian guy, Brennan Mertens. And I was like, hey, man, like I would love to help you with your documentary. I'll ask questions for your Ghostbusters. You'll get to Dan Aykroyd and Ivan Reitman before I will. You ask my questions, we'll swap footage. Mm-hmm. That was like the idea. But then I saw one of the Ghostbuster fans, Tom Gebhardt, was a lot like one of our Santas. I was like, oh, I know how to tell a story. Let me produce and edit it. So we did. So we put the stuff to the side. We did a Kickstarter for Ghost Heads, put it together. A couple people put some money in it, played Tribeca, sold to Netflix, and these guys made their money back relatively fast. They're like, well, what do you got next? And I had this sizzle presentation for Bill Murray, and they're like, let's do it. So they fully funded it. So like, if I'd not just like went on this like weird little side trip to Ghost Heads, Bill Murray would never have been fully funded. And like, we didn't have to do any crowdfunding stuff for
Did
Bill
you
Murray.
Make Ghost Heads? Is that Tom? Is it you directed
I produced and edited that one. Yeah, but it was interesting. It was like kind of like a sequel to Santa, by not using Santa, but using Ghostbusters fans.
Yeah,
it's kind of using like what people do with movies and how it really helps helps
Which
their
kind
lives.
Of ties into the Bill Murray thing, because like you said, this guy is so beloved and so popular, and now has really perpetuated this urban legend myth that he's, like you said, a mythical creature that could show up at any point in time.
Yeah.
There's a great story that you said about the people getting their wedding pictures taken.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, tell that.
Yeah, I mean, so like so we got the funding to do this documentary, and so we just went everywhere. The first thing was South Carolina.
So you're tracking down people that have had these sightings.
Yeah, so we talked to the guy who took the engagement photo, and he's like, just a normal day in South Carolina, taking engagement photos, and then the husband, groom. Yeah. He like started looking to the side. He's like, no, pay attention. He looked around and Bill Murray's got his shirt off and just slapping his belly, you know? And he's like, what's going on? He's like, Bill, you want to be in this picture? So it's just like this whole big thing. But like, once you like face value, talk about the story, it's a funny story. But then you hear like what it did for them, how it made them feel. And like really what Bill is kind of doing. Like he talks about being available, living in the moment, being present. So like you start seeing these words be talked about all the time. And when you put them all together, you're kind of like telling the story of being present, you know? And it's so hard with like our cell phones and internet, so many distractions. But Bill doesn't do that because he doesn't have Twitter. He doesn't have Instagram. There's no Bill going, oh, I had breakfast today. You know, like he doesn't do that. He lives his life in very much in a present sort of moment. If he sees someone who needs some sort of something, he's there for it.
Well, that's the underlying theme that I was talking about earlier, is that he's really doing this as life lessons.
Yes.
You know, because there's somebody, I think somebody written a book or a movie, The Tao of Bill Murray.
Yeah.
And
we interviewed him. Yeah.
I saw that on your movie. Yeah. And we're talking about how Bill lives in the moment. And most of the, I think the word that somebody said was that we're so disconnected in our lives now because we're always on our phones.
Yeah.
Always on the phones. And Bill is, whether there's got to be some reason to it. He's wacky, but he's doing it for a reason, to show people to live in the now.
I think yes, you could say it's this heroic thing, and sometimes maybe it is, but I also think it's something for himself too. Like he says sometimes he's asleep at the wheel. You know, everyone's the Walking Dead. You know, the Scream Awards, he won an award for being in Zombieland,
right,
and he thanked the audience, who he said were the Walking Dead, meaning that like everyone's just asleep at the wheel, you know? And he does these things to kind of wake himself up. You go back to his studies at Second City. Del Close, who's an amazing improv teacher, is very much of a live in a moment, take improv off the stage. When Bill Murray did the movie Razor's Edge and it didn't do well, he went to France and studied philosophy and really got into this guy, G.I. Gurdjieff, who all was about waking people. He would hit people with sticks just to wake them up, to like share this moment. There's a lot of like background knowledge that goes into some of the stuff Bill does. Does he apply that every day? I don't think so. Mm. But I think if he sees it, feels a charge and sees a moment to happen, he'll follow that through.
He had a great part when he was at the San Diego Comic-Con and some fan was asking about, are these rumors true that you go up to people and do these wacky things and say no one's going to believe you? And Bill's just like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, of course, because you got to keep the joke alive, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like, you know, when we were calling him, we weren't trying to like 2020 style and sit down with him and like talk to him. Because if we're making a Bigfoot documentary, you're not going to sit down with Bigfoot and be like, so what's with the woods? it ruins the magic, you know? Like, do you really want to know if Bigfoot exists? No, you want the fun of,
It's the bed. The magician, tell me how you saw the lady in half. Like, you don't really want to know.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because like I said, I thought that was like, there's so many great moments of this. Like, I was thinking to myself, Bill Murray could run for president. You see this stuff. Like, you made the analogy, which was really good, to Meatballs, where they, you know, he tells the kids in camp, it just doesn't matter because no matter what you do, they're still going to date the rich guy.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't matter. Bringing that, like, nothing really matters.
No.
Just enjoy yourself. And
it's all your personal narrative. Like,
you know, right. And how you painted the picture that he's maybe telling us how to be in the moment and connect with strangers.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, that was the greatest thing. It's like, you know, we would go to Austin, Texas and talk to the people who have, you know, had a house party and Bill Murray showed up with the band and started helping the band set up. And when the cops came, like, Bill Murray showed up to the door and the cops were like, no, forget it. You're having a great time. Keep going.
He was playing tambourine with the band when the cops showed up.
Yeah.
They wanted the band to turn down. And the dude was like, well, you tell Bill Murray that he can't play tambourine. And Bill went up to him with the tambourine. He was shaking it in their face, right?
Yeah. And then there's video of that stuff. And they're like, but you could, the smile that the people have when they tell these stories, it just lights them up. And like, you see that behavior and you go, I should do that. You know, and it's like that sort of yes and like improv style where you're like, you know what? We played at South by Southwest, right? And this lady came up to me afterwards. She's like, I had a 2-hour break where I was going to meet up with friends and see a show. And I was going to just go to my hotel room and just fall asleep for 2 hours. But I thought, what would Bill do? And I just explored and I've had an amazing time, you know? And like, it was just like one of those things where like, you could just, I'm tired, but like, just yes and. Like, let's explore. Let's see what's going to happen. And she had an amazing time, you know?
It makes me, because I've heard these stories for years, obviously, as we all have. It makes me feel kind of bad sometimes because I should do that. Like, I'm not Bill Murray, but there's a segment of society that if I did stuff like that, would love it.
Yeah.
And I have done certain things like that at times, but I want to do more of it because like, I bet you it really does make him feel alive. Like you mentioned, South by Southwest, he was 70, hanging out with 20-year-old teenagers playing rock and roll at a dorm party, avoiding the cops.
That doesn't make
you feel like a teenager and make you feel alive. It's like we said about some of the Siren documentary. They were saying like I'm 56 years old, but I feel like I'm 18 again by playing on stage with this rock and roll band. That was their chance to be alive. And maybe, you know, like you said, a guy like Bill, who's been so famous for so long, he's made, you know, a dozen, 25 classic movies. Maybe that's the way that he can keep himself grounded, by going out and hanging out with people.
Well, I mean, I think you said it like one of your last runs with WWE, like, you know, like you're, you know, I, what you said, like late 40s, you know, jumping off like steel cages and doing all that stuff because you're messing around with like Kevin Owens and all these young guys.
Right.
And it made you feel younger. You know, I think that's the secret of it all, is really just to kind of like try to capture some of that youth, even if you're not, you know, like Bill Murray is the youngest 68-year-old person probably ever, you know? And it's because he just does this stuff. He doesn't like just retire into whatever. I'm sure some nights there is that, you know, he's just watching the Cubs game or whatever, but you know, he's out there exploring. And like, you know, when you're on tour, whenever we're making these movies, it's like we could just go back to the hotel room and afterwards and just do whatever. But it's like, no, let's figure out what Phoenix is like.
Let's go see something.
Yeah, what's Scotland have to offer? Let's figure that out.
Right, and it's like, you know, I remember like the last time I was in Scotland or wherever it was, it's like, oh, another castle. And it's like, yeah, a castle. How many castles are you looking at in the United States? Our country's 200 years old. This country's 2000. Get off the frickin' bus and go look at a castle.
Well, so we talked to this lady who's in Scotland, but she was born in Michigan, you know? And she's like, my flat is older than my country. And I thought, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Like, you forget that, like, these things are just so old.
Does Bill do these things kind of around the world?
So Scotland, he was in Scotland because of St. Andrews. It's like the oldest golf course. So there's like a lot of these like celebrities will come to these golf courses. Usually it's a thing that brings them there, whether it's a festival. He was in Slovenia doing something because I think he has like a...
that was great.
Like a liquor company that he was doing something for.
Playing accordion with... Yeah. One of the stories I was going to tell you is that, and I have two of them, is that a friend of mine, he plays every year in the Pro-Am tournament Pebble Beach.
Okay.
So we went there, and he's a pretty wealthy guy. He's actually been on Talk Is Jericho. Todd Wagner is his name. And when he was playing, there's a pro and an amateur, and there's a foursome. So it was Todd, I think he was with Jordan Spieth, and then is Bill Murray was the other am. And they hate him at Pebble Beach because he wears like Chicago Cubs sweatpants and like
PBR pants.
Yeah. And they hate it, but he's Bill Murray, right?
Yeah, of course.
And it's a typical thing. Like anything he does, people are just howling. Like he could just go, hey, there's a bird. Ah, it's a bird. But what he would do is when people are walking, because you hit the ball and then everybody walks down the field. And then what he would do is he would get out of the green and walk behind people on the cement sidewalk and just walk behind them, like really close to them. And so if they were talking, they would turn around, Bill Murray's right behind him. Or if they were talking, he'd be like, man, 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 man. And he's doing it. Like at first I was like, okay, he's just playing to the crowd. I'm like, no, he's amusing himself.
Yeah.
And he's, like you said, he's keeping people in that. You know that I'm here, but you're still not paying attention. I can still surprise you and get you.
Yeah.
You know, I just thought that was really cool that he was still really involved in being almost like an entertainer.
Well, you have to entertain yourself. Like, if you look at the way you guys do like live shows to house shows.
Yeah.
Like I had heard like Foley talk about like Owen Hart doing matches where like someone would hit him with a bag of popcorn and he would sell it like it was a steel chair.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You do these things to keep yourself
entertain
into it.
Yourself.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, there's also too, Bill for Todd's party, but it was there. He gave his Bill Murray wear. And they're like kind of really ugly golf shirts. The
yeah,
one
yeah.
That I have. I wore it once, but it's so ugly. There's like
the William Murray Golf Line.
What's it called?
The William Murray Golf
Line. William Murray Golf Line. And it's all these martinis, like okay. Little martinis. And then every like 10th one is spilt.
Oh, nice.
It's so stupid. I wore it once. I'm like, this is so ugly. But that was kind of the chance to see Bill Murray up close and personal. Like
oh,
you
so you got to see him?
Yeah, because I was there.
Oh, so okay.
I forgot to tell you that. I was there. Watching because my wife wanted to go. She's friends. We're both friends with the Wagners, but you know, I'm not a golf guy. So walking back up and down the court, there's no drinks, the court, the field. The best part was watching Bill Murray and watching people get mad at Bill Murray for being Bill Murray.
Yeah.
I'm like, why the hell? He's probably the major draw of the damn tournament. If he wants to walk off the field in sweatpants, let him do it. Right.
Yeah. Well, there's he's just going to do what he's going to do. You know, like, when they shot Lost in Translation, like he really didn't show up until like the day. And like they weren't sure if he was, they're in Japan waiting for him to show up and going, well, I really hope this happens, you know? And
does he have a reputation of just not showing up ever?
He'll always show up.
Right.
But you just will never hear about it beforehand. Like say yes and then radio silence until the day.
He's not going to text you like, I'm an hour away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is he still, I haven't seen any projects with him lately.
Well, he does everything Wes Anderson, but usually the roles are like smaller, you know? He just did a Jim Jarmusch movie about zombies with Adam from Girls.
Okay.
Adam Driver.
He's into the zombie movies now.
Well, yeah, it's Jim Jarmusch, so it's a weird one, you know? Coffee and cigarettes, all that sort of stuff. And then he's just doing another Sofia Coppola movie.
He still does what he wants to do.
You know what it is? He has his like three directors that he works with and just does that.
That's
you know,
it.
Whenever they're ready for him, he'll work.
They call the 1-800 number.
Yeah, well, I think by that, he does. So not to ruin the myth, but because if his kids are young, he does have a cell phone now so he could text them. But
he's not going to text any directors.
No, he's not.
You know, I love the scene too. And once again, I haven't seen the last 30 minutes, so maybe you can tell a couple of things that happened at the end of the movie. But the last scene that I watched was they're building, is it a library?
The poetry house.
The poetry house.
Yeah.
For people to go into, like, read poetry. And all the construction workers there. But you tell the story.
Yeah, so there's this poetry house in New York, and it was being built. And all the construction workers are just, you know, doing their job. Not to stereotype, but they don't care about the poetry.
They're not much into poetry.
Yeah. So they're, this whatever, but they wanted, like, the poetry people wanted to kind of show what they're building and why this thing is important.
Right.
So they asked Bill, who is a big fan of the Poetry House in New York, and he kind of came in, surprised everyone, and just started reading poetry. the way it's reported is Bill just randomly showed up to a construction site and started reading poetry.
Right.
Yeah, but like it was kind of a little bit set up, but like still, like the people who were doing this had no idea. And he just started reading poetry to these people. And the shots are amazing because, you know, we interviewed them. They're like, you know, we're last time someone read us poetry was probably eighth grade, you know? And the way he kind of like did this thing to connect and just kind of reminded them what they were doing was important work, you know? So it was really fun.
Yeah, he was letting the construction workers know that even though it's a poetry house, it still means something. So by them hearing him read poetry, I think they had more respect for what they were building, you know? Like if they were building a strip club, they might be more excited. But afterwards, but I just thought like now Bill Murray is like helping people hear about poetry. Like it's a very, very magical guy in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's like a jazz sort of poem. You know, like it's just like very impromptu, like just kind of like no set rhythm. It just kind of like goes off to whatever it's wanted to do. It's just he's a unique bird. Yeah.
What you mentioned that you had George the Animal steal, or he's not in the movie?
Initially when we first started doing these sort of interviews, we're like, oh, let's talk to people who were in the movie, you know, in the movies with him, you know? And because I like to put a wrestler in every single one of our movies, I was like, oh, well, George the Animal steal was in Ed Wood with him. So, you know, but George didn't really get really what we were trying to do. He has some great stories about Bill. But then as the movies stopped becoming that and more about these stories, he didn't have those sort of experiences.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was very helpful and was super nice. And so we put all his 5-6 minutes of his interview on the DVD.
So it wasn't so much a Bill Murray documentary. You're doing it about these stories and about this kind of, this mindset that he has surrounding it.
Yeah, there was like the signing in Parsippany, like New Jersey or like New York area. So we went up to him, got interviewed in his hotel room, you know, and he was really nice. You know, but it was just like, it wasn't, you know, it's a lot of it's not his fault. It wasn't the movie someone told me once, if you make the movie you plan on making, you didn't listen to your talent, you know?
Especially and, as a documentary.
It definitely, exactly. You know, so it's like, you know, we were like, let's just try to talk to people who were in movies with them, you know? And that just really didn't work out. Like even like, you know, we interviewed Joel Murray, his brother, and Peter Farrelly, who he did 3 movies with, you know?
Kingpin,
Dumb and Dumber 2, he was in it briefly. Oh. And there was another movie, Osmosis Jones. They did some of the stuff there.
And Dumb and Dumber 2 was a stinker.
now Peter won the Academy Award for The Green Book. So, you know,
he really?
Yeah.
Wow, he got his revenge.
Yeah. But, you know, even with them, like we used probably like 2 minutes of them in the movie.
Was there any good stories that
you could? Yeah, well, in the DVD, we put some stuff in there.
It was a good one that George Animal Steel told you.
Well, George just said he was a special guy, you know, they were filming this one scene in like an ice box sort of thing. And George's wife is there and all that stuff. And you know, obviously George's wife is cold and George wasn't paying attention because he's like, you know, he's in this movie. He's kind of out of his element a little bit. And Bill Murray like puts his jacket on, you know, his wife. And he's like, oh, right. Of course. You know, he's like, thanks, Bill. You know, and like, but Bill saw this moment where his wife was like freezing and like gave him his coat and sort of thing. So it was like, George was just like, appreciated that. But then they became really good friends. Like, I think when George got inducted into the Hall of Fame, Bill might have added like a video.
Oh, okay.
Like he was like with an elephant or something. There's some sort of thing where like they kept in touch, you know. And you know, George Animal Steel being in Florida, they would meet up every once in a while because the Murray brothers have a Caddyshack restaurant in Florida by the golf course. So they kept in touch, which I thought was great, you know.
Another thing about Caddyshack, you mentioned there's the famous line that, you know, hey Dolly, hey Dalai Lama, how about a little something for the effort. And the guy says, you know, when you die, you're going to have total consciousness. So that go for me. It's also very Bill Murray, what we're talking about. He has that total consciousness already, you know?
He's reached, like, I don't want to say nirvana, but like some sort of higher something, you know? And like you, anytime he's improvising in the movies, like there's these little secrets in it. Like Razor's Edge talks about it. Meatballs talks about it. Caddyshack talks about it. Even like some of the stuff of What About Bob, like there's some like inserts of some of his wisdom. And if you just pay attention to it, he's kind of like speaking that.
It's so interesting to me because like this is such an underground, like you mentioned, urban legend that I don't think could ever be more than that. Like even if everybody in Hollywood catches on to this,
yeah,
it's still not like, it's funny, it's quirky, but it's not sexy enough to be a mainstream story.
Right.
It's a very much a San Diego Comic-Con vibe.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, you know what I'm saying to this? It's like I can't see, and not that he wants to, but how Bill would benefit from this other than it just makes his legend even more amazing. You know
what
I mean?
Like, because like he was interviewed after the movie came out on Good Morning America, and they talked about this movie.
About this movie.
It wasn't like set up that way, you know. Like we didn't like book it, you know.
So he knows this movie exists.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, and then like so they asked him, "Hey, Bill, like you know you do these sort of things," and he's like, "I just do them." You know, because it happens. Like, I'm not like, oh, I need to work on my myth today. You know, what can I do to really have people talk about my myth? He doesn't think that way, you know? But when they asked about the movie, he's like, yeah, they asked me to be in it, but a movie about myself, that's something I'll do when I pass away. You know, it's a very Bill Murray answer. Because he's not, like, he got honored at the Mark Twain Award, and he almost didn't show up because, like, he doesn't like to be, like, put on a pedestal that way.
Yeah.
You know? Even, like, when we were setting up to talk to him, like, we didn't want to, like, talk to him. We were like, oh, that'd be cool if he, like, walked by a shot or something, like, Bill Murray-esque,
like
you know?
At the end or something.
Yeah.
But, yeah. At the end of the documentary, like, the hands come around the front of the lens.
Yeah.
And that ends with them going, no one will ever believe you.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah. Well, I made this joke when we would do the Q&As. I was like, the way the Hollywood ending of this movie is how we'll do a Q&A, you know, hopefully a standing ovation. Like, I'm up there on the stage. I'm the only one that could see Bill in the back. He gives me the thumbs up and just disappears. Like, that's the way. Like,
there he is.
Yeah. No one will believe you. That's like, if this was a Hollywood scripted movie, that's how it would turn out. Yeah.
You know, so at least, you know, he got the message. Mm-hmm. So that's because at least he got your messages.
Yeah. I mean, well, at one point, his mailbox was full. And I can't believe it was just me, you know?
No, obviously, there's documentaries, so there's some showbiz. But how many times did you call him?
13 times.
Okay. To be exact.
Yeah. Well, I try to do once a month, you know? And gotcha. we were doing it for a little bit, you know?
So what are some of the things that happened towards the end of the movie? Like, how do you finish it up?
Yeah. I mean, like, we kind of like, I run into Bill. You know, he's a part owner of the South Carolina River Dogs.
Do you really run into him?
I knew he was going to be there.
Well, but so that's the real Bill Murray.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you see the picture of me in the back.
I see the picture here. I was going to ask you, because like, yeah, he's looking at you smiling.
Yeah, there's this documentary called My Date with Drew. It was like early 2000s where this guy wanted a date with Drew Barrymore, and his whole documentary was, I need this date with Drew Barrymore. And that's not what we wanted to do. Like, in the beginning of our movie, we show a picture of me and Bill, and well, let's say this is not what the movie's about. Like, you obviously see I'm with Bill. So I'm not trying to capture Bill or stalking Bill, you know?
You talk about that.
Yeah. So in the ending, you see where that picture kind of lines up and like kind of the takeaway from it, you know? I don't want to ruin too much, it's a neat little
ending.
When
you met him, did you have a conversation or is it just one picture? Or?
Yeah. I mean, like, I went up to him and I was like, you know, hey, Bill, this part was not in the movie because I wasn't wearing a lav and all that stuff. But I was
you knew he was there and you went to find him.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. And because we were working with the team, they were like, you know, they gave us tickets and all that sort of stuff. And I was like, hey, excuse me, Mr. Murray, I'd like to ask you a question real quick. May I ask you a quick question? He was like, well, that was a quick question. And you're like, son of a bitch. You know?
Said what now?
Oh, that was a real quick question. You know? So you're like, son of a
great
bitch.
Great answer.
Yeah. And I was like,
I was like the one who was like, I don't mean to bug you, but you will.
Yeah. It was funny. Like, so can I tell you how I learned to be polite? It's once CM Punk was doing a local TV station, and I was worked for that TV area. And I was like, can I get a picture? And he's like, no, hello.
I know.
I was like, oh my God, like you forget that people are real people,
that's
you
right.
know? And exactly. So ever since then, I learned politeness from CM Punk. Yeah. It was just like, excuse me, you know, person's name here. Yeah. May I, you know, like, but all because of him. But so I was like, excuse me, Mr. Murray, making this documentary about Bill Murray stories. I'd love to talk to you. And he was like, he was just confused because like he was trying to run to his area, you know, like, you know, so he wouldn't get bogged down. He's like, no, I mean, I am Bill Murray, and just kind of like ran off, you know. And I was like, this is not the place to try to pitch this, you know? So we just, the interaction that you see is in the movie towards the end where we just kind of like have a short exchange. I ask for a picture and then he kind of leaves. But like, it's really everything leads to that point and you find out
what
it is.
That's actually really cool that you saw him. That's a great way to end the movie.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, I think it's a really strong ending in that like, we didn't force it because it's like, what's important to me is not important to him, you know? Mm. And I respected that, you know? Like, right there, like, I wanted to make a movie. He wanted to watch the game.
Right.
I'm not going
to get to his seat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so, like, there's no me forcing that, you know? Yeah. And that's not what Bill's is. It's very living in the moment, being present. Like, I was forcing myself onto him, and he was – that's not a part of the Bill Murray game. You know, his is very spontaneous.
And it's not part of the movie that you're telling. It's not the story you're telling either.
Yeah,
the best thing you could have done would have been, hey, I'm Tommy. I called you 13 times. You get my messages?
Yeah, why didn't you call me?
You get my messages?
Yeah.
So along those lines, my other Bill Murray story.
Yeah, okay.
And this is a little bit more of a personal one, was I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I go every year, but this is the year that the E Street Band got inducted.
Oh, nice.
Hall & Oates was there. So I know one of the ladies who runs it. Her name is Betsy Hill. Shout out. She always knows where the after party is. So she got me and my cousin Chad there, and Springsteen is there, and everybody's there. And there's a bunch of people that, yeah, probably like me, like, you know, they're not in any of the bands. Someone knows them, but you got to be cool, right?
Yeah.
So anyways, I was walking around, and Bill Murray was there. And, you know, I didn't say anything to him, but I noticed at one point, about an hour into it, he's obviously wanting to go. But there's this really like large lady that's kind of got him cornered. And I can see just by his body language that he doesn't want to be in this corner anymore. Yeah. So I was a little bit Lotus. I was like, I'm going to go help. I told my cousin, I'm going to go help Bill Murray. So I just walked in front of, between him and the lady. I was like, how are you? Like pretending that I recognized the lady. I was like, how are you? I didn't know you were here tonight. And Bill's kind of standing there. I said, it's time to bolt, Bill. He said, thanks, sport. And dude, he ran, like, power walked out. She's like, Bill. And I said, hey, so it's good to see. I kind of was like doing one of the basketball blocker. I wasn't touching her. But I just remember, time to bolt. Thanks, sport.
That's so funny.
So Bill Murray owes me a favor. Yeah. She should have told me. Yeah. I could have got a hold of when they wanted. Yeah. I don't remember the guy who helped you out of the Rock and Hall of Fame. Can you do an interview with my friend?
That's funny. Well, when George Animal Steel was doing Ed Wood with him, you know, like, he was really, really nervous because he's a wrestler trying to be an actor sort of thing, you know? And
just out of nowhere, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Strange casting, eh?
Yeah, yeah. Well, because like he was very much looked like the person he was supposed to be.
Very much so. Was it Tord Johnson or something like that?
I don't remember. But Bill like made a point. He goes, "Hey guys, let's give this a break. He's a wrestler. He's been acting for a while.
Yeah, right.
He appreciated like the wrestling and the all that sort of stuff. But that's funny, like that you were able to help him out.
I can tell. I've done it for Lars Ulrich before, and I can tell when people are getting comfortable. I don't want anything out of it. Except for, like, that guy was pretty cool. He helped me out.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So what is the process once you make the movie? And this is something that's very interesting to me, and we'll hopefully get a chance to talk about later. How do you sell a documentary? What do you do? I noticed that there's a Hot Docs, Southwest, submission and all these sort of things.
Yeah, so like we premiered at South by Southwest. We got to play at Hot Docs, which is an amazing festival in Toronto. We played BFI in London. Like, we had a really amazing festival run for Bill Murray Stories, mainly because we had Bill Murray's name in the title.
Right.
You know, like, it was not, like, I could have made, like, a bad movie and still, you know, Bill Murray's name's in the title, you know?
Right.
Like, but, like, I really connected with a lot of people. Like, we, in Hot Docs in Toronto, like, the theater is, like, 700 people, and we sell out, like, three nights. You know, like, it was a really, really great run. So we just had a successful festival run, and you know, I'm rep by William Morris, so they were able to sell the movie. It was a split deal with actually William Morris and CAA, and they sold it to Gravitas, and Gravitas got it out, and we were number one documentary on iTunes for an hour.
Hey, we were for Judas with the number one rock song. We beat John Mayer. I took 18 screenshots.
Oh, hell yeah.
I know when it goes, it might not come back.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I knew that. I was like, all right, I don't know how long it's going to be, but I have this screenshot. Yeah.
That's it. That's all you need.
And then we went on Netflix, and we're on Netflix for 2 years. So
that's how it is. You kind of lease it to them for 2 years.
That's currently how we are. Yeah.
See, I can see, because as soon as once again, the small world, as soon as I saw this, the Bill Murray Stories, I was, oh, I want to watch it. I didn't even know that you were attached to it.
And somehow we got a deal where it's on the plane. Like, you,
that's where I saw it, on the plane, yeah.
So what's crazy about that is, like, you know, each rung of it was fun. Like, we had a very, very, very small theatrical run. So some people saw it, whatever. But, like, you know, iTunes, you get a little friends going, oh, I've seen this, or people reaching out to you, haven't seen it in a while. But Netflix, it just blew up. But then the people on these flights, which is crazy, like, we're on international flights and all that stuff. So many people have just checked it out on that, which is crazy to me.
Yeah, and because I hadn't watched it, but that's where I saw it.
Yeah.
What's the Bill Murray Stars? I'll have to put that on my mental list to watch at some point.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's great having a title with a B. Because I just did a movie called Waldo and Weed, which is way more serious, and it played Tribeca. W. You know, like, it was, you could, you know, obviously, going from Bill Murray to someone they don't know named Waldo, you're going to have a different audience there. But I could just even tell with the letters, you know, yeah. Like it's like, oh, there's a different attention here, you know?
What's the Waldo on weed?
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, where's Waldo sort of thing. But it's my friend, his son named Waldo. In 2014, his son had eye cancer at 6 months old. And they started using cannabis oil to counteract the results of the chemotherapy.
Really?
Yeah, and he filmed this whole thing on a flip cam. So he lived in Philly and had to like go to California to smuggle this cannabis oil. And they filmed the whole thing on a flip cam. The kid's 5 years old now, completely healthy. Whoopi Goldberg is our executive producer. And we played a Tribeca. It's an hour and a half movie about this story of this family who... Like, I don't smoke pot. You know, to me, it wasn't a pot story. It was what a father would do to save his son. Sure. My son's 3 years old.
Also,
you know?
I don't smoke pot either, but there's a lot of merit to the cancer, to the weed curing cancer mentality.
We're interviewing, we interviewed doctors from Harvard and Jefferson in Philadelphia. Like, it all started as palliative care. It's like, okay, well, they need an appetite. Let's give them a little bit. And the stuff that this kid's taking is 20 to 1, meaning there's 20 CBD to 1 THC. THC is the thing that gets you high. So the kid's not getting high, mm-hmm. You know. You just they call it the entourage effect. You need a little bit of THC to really pump the CBD, and so it was you started this stuff with powder to get the appetite going, you know. But what the doctors have started to see that it's actually been able to help start fighting cancer. They're way too early to figure out, hey, let's wave the flag. This cures cancer, yeah. You know. But they're waking up and starting to see the hope that a lot of these stories tell.
What how do you get involved with Whoopi Goldberg for that?
You know, when we did I Am Santa Claus, we had Mick Foley in the movie, right? And we knew we needed someone to help bring some sort of prestige to the movie, you know? Like, I just didn't want it to be like, oh, it's Santa Claus and a wrestler. Well, I'm not going to watch this. So right. It's like you had Morgan Spurlock to kind of add that element of, hey, he's a real guy, you know?
Was he in the movie or he just...
Executive producer, gotcha. You know? So same sort of thing was Waldo on weed. Here's this family from Philadelphia that no one knows, you know, and it's our job to make them care about them. So who is someone that, you know, has a high level of like prestige, but also has done documentaries, aware of the cannabis, what cannabis can do right, for people. Yeah. So we reached out to Whoopi Goldberg. We're right by the same sort of
1-800 number?
Yeah, I called her 1-800 number. She got back to me. But no, it was we knew some of the same people and she was able to watch the movie and she gave notes and really helped sculpt it. Like the way the movie originally started was chemotherapy day one. And it was like, cause like I'm kind of like a punk rock kind of guy where I just wanted like, get you, you know? She was like, this is not the way to start the movie. You know, you really want to like understand who these people are. Fall in love with them for a little bit more before you see that chemotherapy. Right. And like, I fought it for a second because I was like, no, indie movies, you know, Quentin Tarantino, you want to shock people, you know, but she was right. You know, you kind of had to like respect who these people were.
You
know,
you are a lot like me where it's like, no, this is my vision. And then Whoopi Goldberg, Oscar winner.
EGOT winner.
Is she an EGOT?
Yes.
You better listen to it, man. I did a battle of the bands that Westwood One asked me to judge at the Troubadour.
Yeah.
At the Roxy, sorry.
Okay.
And the judges were me, John Varvatos, and Desmond Child.
Okay.
Desmond Child wrote Living La Vida Loca.
Nice.
Living on a Prayer. You Give Love a Bad Name. Dude Looks Like a Lady. I Was Made for Loving You. Waking Up in Vegas. You name it.
Sure.
He's got like 100 top 10 hits. So we were watching the one band, and I was like, "Yeah, he's really good, but you guys need better hooks in your chorus. I'm not really hearing a good hook." Thanks, Chris Desmond. I think your songwriting is brilliant, super catchy. And I was like, "Well, when the greatest songwriter of all time tells you you're catchy, don't listen to the fuck I have to say. I'm out of here."
Yeah.
When Whoopi Goldberg tells you to start it a different way,
yeah,
you should probably listen.
But like, you know, I would still show it to some of my like indie friends who made indie docs, and they saw what I was trying to do, and like, I liked it. But I'm not trying to reach, like, you're already asking someone to watch some painful stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, here's a family that you aren't aware of, a 6 month old going through cancer, like chemotherapy.
Yeah.
So why test them even more? So yeah, I was like, you know what? She knows how to speak to a mainstream audience. You know?
You just said it right there. As a punk rock indie filmmaker, it's great. But you, as a filmmaker, as an artist, you probably want as many people to watch it as possible.
But there's a time and a place,
right,
too. You know, like, like, you know, maybe if I was writing a scripted movie and it's like, oh, I want this to be indie. I want this to be a little edgy. Sure. But when your content is so edgy and so hard,
dealing
or difficult,
with a child.
Yeah. Right? You're like, let's just make this as easy as possible.
Right. So what other ideas do you have?
Well, I'm not, I think Brian Gerwitz might have mentioned this to you. I'm not trying to put you on. You can cut this out.
He's going
to
kill you. It's Gerwitz.
Gerwitz. Sorry.
Gerwitz. Yeah, you better say it right.
Yeah. Well, he actually yelled at me because I spelled it wrong too.
I think he's already told me about this.
Yeah.
So I know what it is, but I think it's cool to say.
Yeah. Well, we're working on trying to do an Andy Kaufman versus Jerry Lawler documentary.
Which, by the way, I can't believe has never been done before. Well, such a brilliant story, especially with the king still alive to tell the story.
Oh, he's the best.
He nails it, man. Yeah.
Well, because we work with him on I Am Santa Claus, you know, and he's just amazing, you know. But, you know, we're trying to do it right. We're pitching it out to see if we can do it like a proper way, you know. So hopefully this movie goes and works out. But, you know, the story of Andy Kaufman and Jerry Lawler has always been like they kept the kayfabe, you know, like. But they never really showed what really went into it, you know? And I think that's what I want to do. I'm a huge Andy Kaufman fan, huge wrestling fan. And I was, you know, talk about trying to put you in there too, because you're a perfect example of like you and The Rock, where it's like you're the opposite of of Andy Kaufman, where it's like you went from wrestling to, you know, musician or movie TV person. I mean, you and, Will Forte's movie.
Oh, MacGruber.
Fantastic. Oh, you were so good in that.
Yeah, it was all improv, that scene.
Yeah, I mean, that's so good. To, like, the way they built that up.
Well, they built it up. Are you talking about MacGruber?
Yeah,
MacGruber. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny, because when they made that movie, Yorma Taccone, who's the director, said, this is not going to be a big hit, but it's going to live on for years as a cult classic. He was right.
Yeah.
People commented. I mean, that's once John Mayer's favorite movie. The second time he got mentioned in this podcast is MacGruber.
That's so funny.
So ridiculous, right?
Yeah. But you're the opposite in that stuff. And I think, you know, there's a couple of interviews of wrestlers that I would like to talk to in the movie to kind of talk about that angle. Because a lot of people think that when Jerry Lawler and Andy Kaufman went on Late Night with David Letterman, that was the end of the angle, but it was a very, very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Jerry Lawler threw fire in Andy Kaufman's face. This is a taxi, huge star in 1983, you know?
You know, it's like if David Arquette was a bigger star with the stuff he's putting himself through right now to prove that he really loves the business, which he does, much respect, but that's what Kaufman was doing. Think about how much money Kaufman was making and how his managers must have been, they threw what at you? Fire? Are you crazy?
Well, I mean, like, it's just so ridiculous. Like, Taxi, during 1982 or 83, like, there's no bigger television. There's no, that television ratings and that television money does not exist now.
Right.
You know, and for him just to go, you know, it was before WrestleMania, you know, like, before Mr. T, before Cyndi Lauper, like, Jerry Lawler and Andy Kaufman were WrestleMania before WrestleMania. They were sports entertainment before.
And you know that they originally took that idea to Vince Sr.
Oh, yeah. And
Vince
he said no.
Senior said no.
I don't work with actors, you know?
Yeah. The other thing that I'd always heard, too, just more recently, is that Letterman knew that was going to happen.
So that's so funny, because, like, Jerry, you talk to him, and he's like, he didn't know, you know? But, like, we're talking to David Letterman's people, like, he knew, you know?
If you can get Letterman on there, that's huge. I'm sure he would do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, we're working with $7, and, you know, hopefully the stuff is easy to talk about, good to talk about, but, like, yeah, we're working with David Letterman and The Rock, so it's like, here's the world of wrestling and the world of comedy, and just talking about the influence. Like, you just watch, if you watch David Letterman's show on Netflix, independently, Ellen DeGeneres and Kanye West talked about how Andy Kaufman was an influence to them. Like, you talk about Andy Kaufman just bringing, like, trying to bring a rise out of people, even a negative rise. Mm-hmm. Kanye West saw that and was like, you can do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and look at the way Kanye West is. Look at the way Donald Trump is. Like, it's all Andy Kaufman, you know?
The original Fozzie documentary where we were playing the alternate characters, Moon Goose McQueen, where I would literally go into... I remember I went into Opie and Anthony as Moon Goose McQueen, and they could not shake me. And I was like, this is total Tony Clifton, Andy Kaufman.
Oh, man, isn't
that
great?
I remember saying that to Vince when I was doing something on Sunday Night Main Event, or Sunday Night Heat.
Uh-huh.
And I was saying, you know, I'm never going to break the character. He goes, you have to. I said, well, I'm not going to. It's like, this is Andy Kaufman and Tony Clifton. He goes, no one knows who Tony Clifton is. I'm like, yes, they do. And I'm not breaking character because this is the way I'm doing it. That was such an influence for me, though, because I just loved – how he just, his whole life was booking angles for himself against the world.
So I just had lunch with George Shapiro, which is Andy Kaufman's manager, right? And he talked about the story.
And Tony Clifton sometimes.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, he talked about how Andy didn't want to be on Taxi, right? So George had to do this thing. He goes, I'll do Taxi if they put Tony Clifton on four episodes, you know? So George Shapiro had a negotiated deal with Andy Kaufman and Tony Clifton, both different pay rates, you know, because Andy Kaufman's more popular. Yeah, so when Tony Clifton's time to be in the show, he was supposed to be Danny DeVito's brother. He showed up drunk, two hookers, kind of like in the scene of Man on the Moon, you know? And they wanted to fire him. But in the contract, it said if they fire him, Andy can leave the show, you know? So they said, you know, George is like, look, they really want to fire him. What do you think? He's like, they could fire Tony, but they have to do it in front of everyone. And of course, he makes a big deal. Security has to come in and take...
What are you talking about? Yeah. Fire me.
Exactly. Andy Kaufman is Tony Clifton. He's being pulled out. LA Times are taking pictures. They met up afterwards, like a bank heist, you know? And Andy Kaufman's like, this is the greatest moment of my life, you know? Like, that is
how
heel.
How insane, heel. How insane is it that people actually went along with it? You know, I was like, hey, Kaufman, get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
But
George Shapiro is Jerry Seinfeld's manager. Like, they're like, this guy is like he reps Carl Reiner.
Shapiro reps, yeah, he reps Seinfeld.
He's
too,
a
right?
real manager.
Jeez, man. You know, that's so crazy. I must say, I love that old school. I mean, it is old school Hollywood because you're never going to get that again.
No.
That he was able to do that and basically get away with it. You know, just the genius of that.
And then to go into Memphis, like if he went to New York and did it, it wouldn't have been the same. Right. But like going to Memphis and calling everyone Hicks and the use of soap. Yeah, oh my God.
It worked.
Yeah, I mean, Jerry and him were able to create gold. And like so many people just think it's that Letterman appearance. Mm. And like, so the documentary we want to do is kind of show who Andy Kaufman is. I mean, this guy used to go up on stage at the Improv and just fall asleep on stage. And that was his show. You know, like I just love the bad guy wrestler part of it. Like I used to be in a comedy rap group, like really bad, you know, and we played a show in Atlantic City and one person didn't like our one song. So we played it five times in a row. You know, like I love,
yeah,
I love the heel. I love the bad guy stuff. And so much of what Andy's act was his love and respect for wrestling.
Did you ever watch Jim and Andy, the documentary?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was like, Carrie's just crazy too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's so... So a lot of the stuff we talk about in Bill Murray's stories is Bill Murray is like the intro class to sort of like your ego and living in the moment, being present. And Jim Carrey is kind of the advanced class in that like he kind of speaks in a language that you have to kind of do a little bit of study before you really fully understand
Very
it.
Smart, yeah.
You know, like because like Jim Carrey is like he's really really smart, and some people dismiss him as like crazy where he's talking about like ego and all that sort of stuff. But like he's really on to like really good stuff. Like he has this amazing quote that says, I wish everyone could be rich and famous so they know it's not the answer. Mm. You know, and it's like, well, that's everything, man. Like, you know, like there's no one thing that's going to solve life's misery, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think Jim and Andy
doesn't matter.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think Jim and Andy was a fantastic movie about Jim playing Andy Kaufman. Mm. I mean, a little bit was an example of like, how far can I be a jerk off, you know? But
and how he recreated the whole thing where Jerry pile drove him and he had to leave set with the neck brace.
Yeah, but even like Jerry's like, this isn't how me and Andy talked.
Like, I know. Yeah. But then Carrie's mind it was, because I remember even hearing that, you know, Jim Carrey with neck injury and, you know, the whole thing that they did it. But just as we wind down here, bring it back to Bill Murray. So with all of this, all of these stories and all of this stuff, I mean, what do you think? Do you think this builds upon Bill Murray's legacy in the later stages of his life? Do you think it's made him a bigger star amongst a certain population?
Well, see, like I'm in my late 30s, you know, like
yeah.
I know a Bill as Ghostbusters, you know, and then I'm sure there's a generation behind me or a couple years behind me or like know him as like
the guy.
Or no, yeah, or even that
behind
or,
you.
Sorry, yeah, behind me, meaning like a lot of the Rushmore and all those
sort
of
Wes
movies.
Anderson.
Wes Anderson movies. But I think there's a generation that's happening right now that only kind of knows Bill as this guy from the 80s that does weird things,
right.
You know? And I think the movie really speaks to that. It's like, okay, well, it's not just like an article you see online that's like, hey, isn't this guy do weird things and isn't it fun? Shows that there's like an actual like life lesson to be learned from it, you know? And I like doing that sort of stuff, you know, where it's
and
like...
That's the tagline, life lessons learned from a mythical man.
Yeah,
that's
it's true.
That's a great tagline.
Yeah, I mean, like, it could just be a silly documentary, but we tried to put the heart in there. You know, same thing with Santa, same thing with this.
That's what documentary is.
Yeah.
Like I said, to really get to the crux of it, it's not, like you said, it's not about Bill Murray, or it's not about the heavy metal band Siren, or it's not about Santa. It's about the stories of why people do this and how it makes them feel alive to be a part of it.
Yeah. You know? Well, when we first met, we talked about the greatest heel in ever is Billy Mitchell in King of Kong. And yeah. That's a fantastic story. It's not about arcades game. It's like one guy who had a lot and the other one who's trying to, it's just this big, one good versus evil.
The system, yeah, good versus evil.
Yeah.
Steve Wiebe's the baby face and Billy Mitchell's the heel.
What an amazing heel.
Great heel. Even to this day, he still wears the same tie.
Yeah, I follow him on Instagram.
I think I told you was one time I ordered a case of his hot sauce to send to Eli Roth and his brother Gabe Roth because we love that movie. And for some reason, Billy Mitchell, I guess he calls all his customers. And I was waiting to talk to Vince McMahon and I got a call just as I was about to go in. It was Billy Mitchell. Hello, Chris. Thank you for buying my stuff. Vince, will see you now. No. I got Billy Mitchell on the line. Yeah. So last two questions. What's your favorite Bill Murray movie? And what's your favorite Bill Murray story?
My favorite Bill Murray story is him doing the dishes in Scotland. You know, it's just like, it was just some party in St. Andrews. He kind of showed up and just saw that there was dirty dishes. It's like, don't worry, I'll do them. Like, to me, that's like, I can't imagine Brad Pitt or even like people like a Tom Hanks or something like that who does do silly weird things.
Super cool, yeah.
Yeah, like I just like, it's just so Bill Murray. It's so random. I think random is always just so funny, the absurdity of.
But once again, he comes from SCTV because I'm Canadian, Second City background.
Yeah.
Which is always about the observe, about absurd. Committing to something and sticking with it. Because that's, I remember when I was with the Groundlings, they said, don't try and be funny, just commit. Because commitment is funny.
Yes.
Trying to be funny is not, you know?
I forgot you did the Groundlings. I've been wanting to check a show out there. I haven't done that yet.
It's great, man, Melrose.
Yeah.
My favorite Bill Murray story is when he goes to the party and he takes over the DJ booth and he starts playing, he's DJing for 45 minutes at the party.
I don't think I even know that one.
It's in your story. It's in your movie.
The DJ.
He goes to a party and he's DJing the
piano thing?
No, where he's playing like Jesse's Girl and he's like dancing and singing.
Oh,
at the
right,
party.
Right.
He was DJing the party, right?
Yeah. To me, like the story music. Is the turn down for what? The Lil Wayne. He's like dancing with all the people. Yes.
Yeah, but he was in charge of the music.
You're right.
In my house, I'm CJ the DJ, so I play the tunes.
Gotcha.
I'm not sitting up there like David Guetta or something.
That's what I was, sorry.
He's controlling the music at the party and getting people to dance and have a good time.
Yeah.
He said it was really like, it was kind of like dinner party music. And Bill was like, no, we're going to put some tunes on.
Yeah, because like it was his birthday and someone else's birthday. And they all kind of had this like fun celebration. But as the way Brett, the chef, explains it, he's like, the energy needed to be brought up.
Yeah.
And Bill Murray was the guy who was going to bring it up. Yeah.
Favorite Bill Murray movie?
I'm going to say Ghostbusters.
Wow.
You know, because like, I guess I'm the right age for that movie where I just loved it. And then when it started getting re-released, I was like, oh, this is really, really funny. Like, as a kid, I loved the cartoon and all that sort of stuff. So I fell in love with that. But I don't know. Like, I mean, Lost in Translation is pretty great. But yeah, I have a soft spot for Ghostbusters.
I'm going to go with What About Bob?
Okay.
I think just that whole movie, how it, you know, switches from Bill being the nutcase and Richard Dreyfuss being the straight guy and switching completely to where Dreyfuss is insane.
There's some great stories.
His own house.
Yeah, there's some great stories of him giving Richard Dreyfuss a really hard time.
Really? Yeah. Give us those. Well,
I guess Richard Dreyfuss might have been very serious.
Very uptight.
And Bill doesn't like uptight people. Like, if executive people come, they can't wear suits. Like, he'll just give that person a hard time, or we won't even talk to that person. So I think he just riled him up to kind of really get that anger out of there. Like, I think that anger you're seeing for him is a little bit real. Yeah. That's out of nowhere.
The last story when the guys at the Comic-Con, was it Mitch Glazer?
Yeah.
And to tell the story about Roadhouse?
Yeah. So Mitch Glazer's wife is in Roadhouse.
Kelly Lynch.
Oh, yeah. And then she has sex with...
Patrick Swayze. She's the leading lady. So her and Patrick are banging quite a few times. It is a great love scene.
But and so Bill will call up Mitch Glazer. He's like, he's banging your wife again, you know?
Yeah. He said like he was in China one time.
Yeah. But then Patrick the brothers call. You know, he's had like three or four brothers, you know? Like family's like nine people strong. And they'll call up all, and I was like, oh, he's... Patrick Swayze is banging your wife right now. Like all in the middle of the night and stuff like that.
Tommy, it's great talking to you, man.
Thank you so much.
My biggest regret is we didn't get off our asses and do the Black Friday movie when we had a chance.
I know, right?
Stupid technology.
It would have been good, but we missed it by like 5 years.
I'll think of something else.
Yeah.
Cyber black market.
Awesome. Thank you, man.
Thanks, man.
Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks to Tommy Avalon. You can see the Bill Murray stories, Life Lessons Learned from a Mythical Man on Netflix and Amazon. That's out now. Waldo on Weed is still in production, but coming soon. Find out its release date by following the movie on social media, at Waldo on Weed on the Twitter. And don't forget also, I Am Santa with Mick Foley. It's another great, great movie to watch. And you can find Tommy on Twitter as well, at Tommy Avallone. That's A-V-A-L-L-O-N-E 3. Go check it out. And make sure to check out Chris Jericho's Rockin' Wrestling Rager Part 2 on the Twitter, at Chris Jericho, what is it? At Jericho underscore Cruz. We're 96% sold out. It seems like every week we get a little bit closer as we are. Book your cabin now. You still got a chance. There's, I don't know, about 40 cabins left or so. There's still some good ones. Go check out ChrisJerichoCruise.com. If you want to come join with all in all the fun on the ship, we are loaded down with talent. Ric Flair will be there. Woo! The NWO, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, X-Pac, Jake the Snake Roberts, Booker T doing his Hall of Fame podcast. Queen Charmel is going to be there. MVP is doing his one-man show. Brad Williams is the host. Vicky Guerrero is the special cruise director. Eddie's and Vicky's daughter, Shawl, will be on the ship with her burlesque troupe, the Vaudettes. Chavo Guerrero Jr. will be there as well. It's a whole lot of Guerreros. Whole lot of Guerreros going on. Jack Slade is the keeper of the ice. Red Cup Jeff is the head bartender. Eric Bischoff and Conrad Thompson, 83 weeks live on the ship. At least I think so. I haven't heard anything since Eric is now back with the WWE, but we'll find out, I guess. Fozzie's playing. We got a new song for you. It's in the works. It should be out very, very soon. Farewell to Fear is going to be there. Dark Sky Choir is going to be there. Rubik's Cube, Killer Queen, the greatest female Queen cover band ever. The Dave Spivak Project, Jared James Nichols, Light the Torch, and Kick-Ax. I did a great interview with Kick-Ax for Talk is Jericho. It'll be coming out probably in a month or two. AEW is going to be there. Man, Kenny Omega, the Young Bucks, Cody Rhodes, Hangman Page, MJF, who was amazing on Talk is Jericho a few weeks ago, or earlier this week, whenever that was. Brandi Rhodes, Nyla Rose, man, so many. Dr. Britt Baker, Jungle Boy, and many, many more to be announced later today. It's Friday. So Beyond the Darkness is going to be doing ghost stories kind of on the ship. DDP doing yoga. How much more do you want? Come on, ChrisJerichoCruise.com. We don't want to leave you behind. You're getting down to the wire. So also getting down to the wire for Fozzie's next shows. Mick Nickelback and Fozzie, August 22nd and 24th. Uncasville in Atlantic City. Of course, Fozzie with Iron Maiden at the Bank of California Stadium, Los Angeles, September 14th. That is sold out, or so I've heard. September 5th, Denver, Colorado Springs, Grand Junction, Salt Lake City, Crystal Bay, Nevada, San Francisco, Sacramento, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, San Diego, Tempe, Arizona, Tucson, Arizona, El Paso, Texas, Dallas, Houston, Hattiesburg, Mississippi, Atlanta, Georgia. If you live in those towns, go to FozzieRock.com and check out all ticket information and all Fozzie VIP information. You don't want to miss out on the best VIP in the business. We do a private show just for you. Hang out. Have a great time. FozzieRock.com. All right. Coming up on Wednesday, Jack Slade returns for Banned, the SummerSlam preview that the WWE does not want you to hear. And we've been warned by the WWE to be nice. So we'll do our best on that. So we'll see you then. Have a great, great weekend. Stay hungry. Stay hard. Stay wet. Stay peace, love, hugs, all that great stuff. And a big yeah, boy. And go check out the Bill Murray stories now.